May it please the court, Chief Justices, Mr. Donovan, and counsel of record. For the record, Brian Chapman and I represent Leonard Taylor, the defendant below, appellant, with respect to his direct appeal from his convictions at trial in the Superior Court. If I may, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for my rebuttal argument.
Very well. The yellow light will come on when you're into your reserve time.
Thank you. In papers which I have previously filed with the court, I've made two arguments regarding rulings made in the trial court, each of which violated the appellant's constitutional rights to a fair trial. Before specifically addressing those arguments, I'd like to point out a few facts which I think provide some context and highlight the effect of these rulings with regards to my client's right to a fair trial. The victim in this case was murdered on May 2nd of 2009, and my client was indicted for that murder not until October 26th of 2009. This was a case that was investigated by several different police agencies from three states for a significant period of time prior to any indictment coming against my client. The reason for the significant delay in the indictment was there was no real physical evidence to identify.
In between the murder and the indictment, there's the arrest. What was the date of arrest?
I believe the date of the arrest was
for murder.
Late August of 2009.
All right.
The reason for the significant delay in the indictment was there was no real physical evidence to identify whom committed the murder. The murder weapon was never located. There was no DNA evidence. There was no fingerprint evidence. Thus, the state's case relied solely on testimonial evidence, which obviously would have been of great deal of importance in the presentation of that testimonial evidence to the jury. Due to the lack of physical evidence, the testimonial evidence of the business associates of the victim, Ricardo Rimple and Darian Newton, was of most importance and most influential for the jury in terms of making their decision. It was known by all counsel that both Newton and Rimple were both interviewed several times by law enforcement, and they had each gave contradictory versions to the police as to the events of what happened on May 2nd, 2009. This leads me into my first argument in the appellant's opening brief with regards to the direct testimony of Ricardo Rimple. He was the first civilian witness to testify for the state. There was several law enforcement individuals who had testified, but he was the first true testimonial civilian witness presented. On his direct examination, there was some questions from the prosecutor which were clearly attempting to endear Rimple and his credibility to the jury. Again, this was on direct examination. At no point had his credibility or issues with regards to his testimony been brought up. The first question Taylor's trial counsel objected to as it, again, attempted to endear Rimple to the jury. The judge took note of the objection, was sympathetic to the objection, was sympathetic to the basis for the objection. However, he just ordered the state to move on. The state at that point, again, continued to try and build up Rimple's credibility and also endear him to the jury, even though it was well known he was one of the four associates involved in this illegal business, which ultimately resulted in the murder of Sven Hines. The questions continued, and finally then there was a question which was asked to Mr. Rimple, to which he responded that the reason he was nervous to testify was because he had been assaulted a couple times up in New York.
Now, that was or was not the expected answer?
That was not the expected answer.
So the prosecutor did not expect that answer, and defense counsel did not expect that answer.
Justice Ridgely, that is my reading of the transcripts, that that's correct. Yes, it was not an expected answer. However, I think it's fair to say from the way the proceeding happened, the question had been asked and answered several times. It was an unnecessary question, and it was, again, offered in direct examination prior to the credibility or any testimonial issues with regards to Ricardo Rimple and his examination.
So your client's trial attorney moved for a mistrial. And the Superior Court denied the motion for a mistrial and gave a curative instruction. Is that right?
That's correct, Justice Hall.
And what was the nature of the curative instruction?
I believe it was, Justice Holland, do you want me to read the exact curative instruction, or would you like?
As my understanding from the record is that the trial judge told the jury, you've just heard testimony that the witness was in fear because of prior assaults. I'm telling you, those prior assaults have nothing to do with this case.
That's correct. There was a written curative instruction by the state, which was provided to defense counsel at that time, and then the Judge Vaughn did read that to the jury. That's correct.
Well, specifically, didn't he say, there is no evidence that relates such incidents to this case in any way?
Justice Ridgely, that is correct. The argument is, if I may, that at that point, the cat was out of the bag. The implication had already been drawn that my client had ordered that witness to be assaulted in New York. Furthermore, all attorneys in the case knew that there wasn't going to be any evidence presented to the jury to establish anyone else had reason or motive to assault Mr. Rimple up in New York. So in the very beginning of this murder trial, the jury was provided information that, inferable information, that my client was involved in assaults of a witness testifying. And then as they go to deliberate, after they've heard all the evidence, there has been no other evidence provided by the state or the defense to show that there was anyone else who had an inference to harm him.
I want to understand your contention. Is it your contention then that the instruction should have read, there is no evidence that relates the defendant, in this case, Mr. Taylor, to those assaults? Would that have been sufficient?
Justice Ridgely, I think there's a ongoing battle in the course of a trial to determine if a curative instruction like that can truly be effective. And obviously, you know, the measures are the curative instruction, or, you know, grant the motion for mistrial, or we don't give a curative instruction. The fact is the information has already been put in front of the jury. Obviously, they have an obligation to listen to the judge and the law he provides. My position is this was at such an early point in the trial, and the information provided was so damaging to the defendant that the mistrial should have been granted, as opposed to the curative instruction, which I don't think.
So no curative instruction, no matter how precisely worded it might have been, would have sufficed. I mean, that's your position?
At that point in time, with regards to this specific issue,
at
yes.
At that point in time, with regard to this specific issue.
Justice Jacobs, with regards to the fact that there had been so many prior questions.
Just yes or no would suffice.
Yes, then, Justice Jacobs.
Your position is, it was reversible error because, notwithstanding this curative instruction, the only conclusion the jury could have reached from the question and the answer is that Taylor had assaulted this witness before.
Yes.
And how do you get that from the record, that it was Taylor specifically in the context?
Justice Holland, the questions presented to the witness Rimple prior to the response which drew the mistrial were focused on why he was nervous about testifying, why he was worried about testifying, and the answers prior to that question which drew the motion for the mistrial were, you know, I'm worried about my people back at home, and there was a theme of the fact that he was worried about the fact that he was going to be called a snitch. And I think everyone involved believed that's what he was going to expound on, and he didn't. And I think that because of what came out of his mouth in response to that answer, that he had been beaten up a couple times in New York, and there was no further explanation as to who did it, it was going to be very clear to the jury, once all the evidence had presented, that there was four business associates involved in this case. There was the victim, the defendant, Rimple, and Newton. And Newton and Rimple, the testimony came out, were pretty tight. And he was also testifying. So he, in essence, was a snitch as well. So then what we're left with is, who do we have to, who's the most obvious inference that would be the person that would wish to harm Rimple? That would be the defendant. And that's then compounded by the fact that there's no testimony throughout the trial to show that anyone else had motive to anyway harm Rimple.
What I'm having trouble with is connecting three separate issues. One would be that if you're a snitch, depending on where you live, you may be unpopular. The other would be that Taylor beat this person up before. And the third would be Taylor is not going to be happy with him because he's testifying at the trial. So there are three different reasons why you would be concerned about testifying. But you're telling us the only logical inference is that Taylor had been involved in somehow assaulting this person in the past.
Yes.
Okay. Do you want to go to your second point?
If I may, yes, thank you. The second argument, which has been presented in my papers, goes to the testimony of Eric Briggs, who was a prison informant. I testified on behalf of the state. He initially was interviewed by Detective D. Gregorio on July 20th, 2009. At that point, my client had not been charged with this murder. Mr. Briggs meets with Detective D. Gregorio. The information he has is pretty general. D. Gregorio orders him to go back in.
So just to back up, as I understand the record, your client was in jail in Maryland for a violation of probation or another crime.
That's a violation of probation.
And this fellow, Biggs, was his cellmate.
Correct.
And during the course of their mutual incarceration in Maryland, Taylor, according to Biggs, told him about a murder Taylor had committed in Delaware.
Correct.
Okay, so let's pick up where you were.
Okay. It's clear from Briggs's interview with D. Gregorio and his testimony that at some point prior to Briggs meeting with D. Gregorio, Taylor shows Briggs a card of a lawyer, says he's, you know, being represented on these charges, according to Briggs's testimony. D. Gregorio sends Briggs back into the prison, says, get me more detailed information, start talking to him, listen to him, get us some more information. When you have something, contact us. I'll come back and interview you. Briggs does exactly that. Provides another statement on July 30th, 2009, and then ultimately testifies at the trial of my client. Taylor's trial counsel filed a motion to exclude that statement.
Is there a material difference between the information that Briggs obtained before talking to the police and the information that Briggs obtained after talking to the police? I mean, are there material differences or material facts that are added?
Justice Ridge, I believe there is much more detail, more material facts in the statement that Briggs gave to D. Gregorio on July 30th as opposed to the general, not as detailed statement he gave on July 20th, 2009, yes.
What did he say on July 20th? This was before
it was
the police had talked to him and he basically got information from Taylor. What information did he receive?
The information was more in a general sense in terms of Briggs advised he was, you know, in a cell or in close proximity to Taylor, and I believe the quote was someone that had done him dirty and he had shot someone three times in the back of the head. I believe that was the extent of the details that were provided from the July 20th statement.
Basically then that Taylor had confessed to an execution style murder of someone who had done something to him.
Correct. In a general sense, yes.
Okay.
And then on the July...
So do you concede that would have been admissible?
Yes. Yes, I do. And the reason for that is I believe when Briggs went back in to the prison, he was doing so as a law enforcement agent. He was ordered to go back in there to get more details and then contact De Gregorio. De Gregorio was fully aware my client was represented.
In what capacity he was represented for the BOP hearing?
That's very unclear in terms of he had shown Briggs a card and said, I'm represented by this guy on everything, was what's in the transcript that Briggs stated to, I believe.
And do you want to save your remaining time?
No, at this point I'd like to just continue if I may.
All right, well then, continuing, do you agree that what Briggs did not violate the Sixth Amendment?
Under federal law principles, yes. The Sixth Amendment is offense-specific. My client had not been charged with this murder. I believe the stronger argument rests with the Delaware Constitution in Article 1, Section 7, looking at the Bryan versus State case. In looking in that case, I think the court has, in Bryan, they established that there's no distinction between an in-person request by retained counsel or a telephonic request by that lawyer. Looking at the specifics of this case, again, there was four police agencies over three different states investigating this case. It was almost impossible for the attorney representing Taylor to contact any police agency in Delaware, Maryland, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania and say, hey, don't interview my client on this. Furthermore, he couldn't sit at the VOP facility where my client was being held and say, don't talk to my client about this. So in essence, my position is he did the next best thing, gave him a card and said, hey, don't talk to anyone, show them the card.
But he showed that to the cellmate had this knowledge, but the police were only getting this secondhand, isn't that correct?
100% correct, yes. I apologize for interrupting. My client was interviewed by Detective De Gregorio on July 9th of 2009, 11 days before he first interviewed Briggs. He never attempted to interview my client subsequently from hearing from Briggs that Taylor had showed him the lawyer card.
Right. Well, tell us how you get from the precedent in Bryan to the winning argument in this case.
I'm not going to sit up here and it's a jump. It is. I will acknowledge he was in custody on a VOP. He wasn't specifically charged for this murder. That being said, under Article 1, Section 7 of the Delaware Constitution, there's broader protections than the United States Constitution provides.
So what is the rule, the constitutional rule under the Delaware Constitution that you would ask us to adopt?
The procedural protections provided by the Delaware Constitution demand that an accused be afforded an unqualified opportunity to consult prior to custodial interrogation with an attorney, provided that attorney has made a reasonable, diligent effort to render legal advice or perform legal services. The specifics with this case are unique in the fact that, again, it wasn't possible for an attorney who represented Taylor to contact every law enforcement agency in the mid-Atlantic area and say, don't interview my client with regards to this murder. It also wasn't possible for him to sit there and make sure Taylor didn't get interviewed. So he provided the card, which, again, it's not the exact equivalent, and it is a jump for the court in light of their decisions in Bryan, you know, and Article 1, Section 7, but the effort was made by the attorney to give the card, to make sure Taylor had the card, and to make sure Taylor wasn't interviewed without legal representation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. If it pleases the court, Timothy Donovan, representing the state. I take issue as to the first argument with my colleague's position that at the time Mr. Rimple testified on direct examination, there was no reason to test his, to talk about his credibility because that had not yet been challenged. The credibility of Mr. Rimple and Mr. Newton was challenged right from the beginning during defense counsel's opening statement. It was no secret that that was going to be the main battleground, that these individuals, Mr. Rimple and Mr. Newton, because they had given misleading, they had given, in Mr. Newton's case, actively, positively false statements to the police for which Mr. Newton was charged with hindering prosecution, that because their statements, as they gave them, were less than accurate, that they had definite credibility problems, and the fact that they were involved in the drug dealing with Mr. Hines and Mr. Taylor, and the fact, of course, that they had helped Mr. Taylor get rid of the body after the murder. I mean, they obviously had credibility problems, as were pointed out by defense counsel in opening statement. So that was an issue right from the beginning. And there was certainly no error in simply exploring that issue during direct examination. Now, as to the blurting out by Mr. Rimple and Mr. Maurer, and I think my colleague now concedes this was unexpected, when he says that he had been assaulted in Brooklyn, the judge then gave the instruction and was simply to ignore that testimony. It has nothing, that he was assaulted had nothing to do with this case.
Mr. Donovan, what was the expected answer?
The expected answer was that he lives in a neighborhood in which, as the expression is, snitches get stitches. It was a no-snitching neighborhood, and that were he known as a snitch, as apparently he was, for that reason and that reason alone, he would be taught a lesson, as he apparently was. When the word got out that he was cooperating with the police, even though it wasn't in New York, it was down in some place called Delaware. Nevertheless, he was cooperating with the police. And this is something that then Mr. Rimple explained. It's on page A98, page 38. Well, in most neighborhoods, this is Mr. Rimple, this is after the objection, in most neighborhoods, basically in Brooklyn, New York, well, in New York, there is no snitching. If you see something, you don't say anything. You mind your own business. You don't talk to the police. You don't. They don't believe in that. There is consequences for that. So it's in general. It really has nothing to do, according to Mr. Rimple, with this specific case, let alone with Mr. Taylor hiring somebody to go and beat him up or anything like that. This is simply in general. When the word gets out, he's cooperating with the police someplace. Well, there's going to be consequences for that. So I think the judge's instruction, plus Mr. Rimple's subsequent explanation as for why he was, well, the culture in which he lives, the no-snitching culture, I think put to rest any possibility that the jurors would infer that Mr. Taylor had put somebody up to this, which, of course, would...
What's the connection between being afraid to testify and credibility?
Between
credibility,
yes,
and being afraid to testify. You're saying this testimony about and questioning about why are you afraid to testify was permissible.
Yes.
Even though it got an unexpected answer. But it was all permissible because the witness's credibility was an issue. So my question is, what's the connection between being afraid to testify and credibility?
The fact that he had made so many inconsistent statements in the past. It went to say why he did not want to cooperate with the police, why he did not want to be a witness, why he did not come forward after the murder and say, I just witnessed the murder of officers and I know who did it, why he spent so much time, in essence, trying to get himself out of this fix he was in. And this is one of the reasons. So it does go to credibility now that he's now testifying. Why the problem is, as trial counsel pointed out, all these prior inconsistent statements where he's holding back information, or Mr. Newton's case, giving materially misleading information. So the fact that he comes from this culture in which cooperation with the police is frowned upon, which one simply doesn't do it, has to go to explaining that. I'm sorry, my red light just went off. But
I don't think that's right. Make an adjustment.
I'm sorry?
I will adjust it.
Oh, thank you. As to the second issue, let me just clarify a few little facts there. There were, as the court is aware, a number of different police agencies involved in this. Lieutenant Di Gregorio from New Jersey first learned that Mr. Taylor had been incarcerated. That was, he was arrested, pulled over for a motor vehicle violation, and arrested on the violation of probation, which was an outstanding warrant, on July 7th. Lieutenant Di Gregorio from Carney's Point learned of this and interviewed him as searching for leads. I don't even know that he was a suspect at this point. But Lieutenant Di Gregorio, who at this time was really the chief investigating officer, because that's where the body was found, and nobody knew where the murder had occurred as of this point. So he was trying to trace Mr. Taylor. He had a name, Panama, well, one of his nicknames, but he knew that Mr. Taylor had Delaware connections and was trying to find his mother, and eventually did, and learned that Mr. Taylor was incarcerated in New Jersey, and went to talk to Mr. Taylor to see if Mr. Hines had any associates, and learned from him the possibility of possible, the identities of possible suspects. And during his statement, Mr. Taylor gave the name of this fellow by the nickname of Black, or Mr. Black, who was a drug dealer and a robber and an altogether bad person, and who had had some dealings with Mr. Hines and was perhaps a suspect they should be looking for. Then, again, the Mr. Briggs was in a cell, with a dormitory-type cell, with Mr. Taylor, and Mr. Braid contacted the prosecutor, wrote a letter to the prosecutor there saying he had some information regarding a murder involving Mr. Taylor, and the prosecutor then contacted New Jersey. Lieutenant Di Gregorio came and talked to Mr. Briggs on the 20th. Now, in the meantime, as this is going on, Delaware police, in particular Newark, police are going around everywhere looking at motels, you know, wondering where these people were staying, try to track them down. And Newark police, shortly before the July 20th interview, I think it was on July 17th, came upon the Super 8 Motel in Newark and found out that the four of them were staying there, and using that luminol, found traces of blood between two beds in one of the second floor rooms rented by the four individuals. Now, apparently, Lieutenant Di Gregorio had not yet been told of that, because he went and talked to Briggs on the 20th, but somewhere in there, he handed the investigation off to Newark, because then Newark, not Di Gregorio, went back on the 30th and talked to Briggs themselves. So there were two statements by Briggs, each one given to a separate police department. Now, as to Mr. Taylor's representation, Mr. Briggs is perhaps not the most articulate person in the world, and his statements are certainly very incriminating, but trying to put them together as puzzle pieces is rather difficult. So it's difficult to see who he's talking about and what card this was that Mr. Taylor was given. On page the transcripts of Mr. Briggs' statements on page 479. He is talking about a lawyer named Dave Hennigan. He's also talking about someone named Maria, who may have something to do with bail bonds people. So it's unsure, and it sounds like Mr. Hennigan is representing him on the VOP.
Well, there were facts after Mr. Taylor was arrested. Did Mr. Hennigan represent him in any way on the murder charges?
No. He's strictly a Maryland attorney. There is nothing. But the on August 19th...
Well, was he arrested in Maryland?
He was. What we did, the one of the statements, according to Mr. Briggs, that Mr. Taylor had made was, once I get out, I'm going to run. Mr. Taylor was from Jamaica, and the police knew he had family in Jamaica, and were afraid that after the July 30th Briggs statement, he was...
Was he arrested in Maryland?
We lodged a detainer against him on August 19th, I believe. And at that time, I believe he was going to get out right then, which is why the police acted when they did.
Is there anything in the record that shows that Mr. Hennigan was involved in that?
No, there is nothing on the record. I can't say that he was or that he wasn't. But in any event, legally, Taylor has there's no legal reason. He had no Sixth Amendment right as to either of these statements. Adversarial proceedings had not yet begun against him. He was not, after the initial statement he made to Lieutenant DiGregorio on July 9th, he was not questioned by the police again. After the July 20th statement, certainly Mr. Briggs was acting as a police agent. Mr. Briggs, there was no reason for him to read Miranda warnings to the defendant. And the case on which I rely most strongly would be Jackson v. State, which is very similar to this, in that Mr. Jackson was charged with and was pending a murder trial, and while incarcerated was attempting to arrange for the murder of a witness.
The only issue with regard to the second claim of error is whether there was a violation of the Delaware Constitution.
Well, then that's Bryan versus David. Bryan's a very different case. I mean, I know my friend, my colleague is relying on it that this court did in Bryan go to the Delaware Constitution, primarily because of the case of Moran versus Burbine, where the behavior of the police in Bryan, they arrested this young man for murder, and despite the fact that they had been told he had previously been arrested for theft, and the police had been told by his attorney, do not question him on that. They arrested him for murder. They were also told, again, it was an out-of-state attorney, so he was contacting them by telephone, do not question him. And the police went ahead and did not tell the defendant that his attorney was trying to get in touch with him, read him Miranda warnings because they had arrested him, and he waived. And in the course of the interrogation, confessed to the murder. And under Moran versus Burbine, the United States Supreme Court would say that's all right. The police had no duty to inform him, to inform the defendant that the lawyer was outside or contacting them telephonically, as long as the police delivered the proper Miranda warnings and got a proper waiver. But this court said no. We recognize Moran versus Burbine stands for that proposition. But under the Delaware Constitution, which can confer greater protections under circumstances such as these, we are going to find a Delaware constitutional due process violation in the actions of the police here. The police are going to obtain a voluntary knowing waiver of Miranda warnings of the right to counsel. The police have a duty then to inform the defendant that there's a lawyer, he has a lawyer, and that lawyer is telling him not to talk to us, and which the virtue of making sense, but certainly under the Delaware Code, that's not this case. I mean, there's nothing about this case that's any way, shape, or form like this. The defendant had no adversarial proceedings had begun, and this is more akin to the Jackson case, where the court held that as to the pending murder trial, they could not use the informant's information. That case, at the penalty phase of that murder trial, was a capital case. But as far as the case of attempted murder of a witness for which the defendant had not been charged, there would be no constitutional, either federal or Delaware constitutional. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Donovan.
Thank you.
Mr. Chapman, you have a few moments. Do you have anything that you'd like to say?
No, thank you.
Thank you. And thank you both for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.